Chapter 14. With the fall of Phoenix Crag, the war on Shrike was as good as over, though, as with any conquest of such scale, isolated pockets of fighters remained. The mountains were rife with hidden eyries that not even the divinations of the Corviday could uncover, and it was certain more blood would be spilled before compliance became complete. While the Uranti Drax garrisoned the city, Kelophis led the Prospero Spire Guard and Lacunan Life Watch in the task of hunting down the rogue Eyries. The maniples of crystal-joined robots of the Sixth proved invaluable in the work, climbing into the highest crags without fear, exhaustion, or complaint. The warriors of the Sixth Fellowship employed their tutelaries to channel the fire of the Puree into the heart of the mountains, burning out their enemies and setting the peaks ablaze. Less than 10 hours after the victory confirmation, Lehman Russ led his warriors from Shrike. Russ's flagship, the Harankle, led the Space Wolf expeditionary fleet from the Ark Reach cluster without fanfare or promises of brotherly camaraderie. Nothing more had been said of the confrontation before the Great Library, but the matter was far from settled. Magnus dismissed it as irrelevant, but those closest to him saw that the encounter had shaken him, as though it had confirmed some long-held fear. Civilians were afforded the opportunity to descend to the surface, and an army of iterators from the 47th Expedition began the long process of inculcating the populace with the enlightened philosophies of the Imperium. The word-bearers participated in this process with the zeal of missionaries, shipping whole swathes of the populace to vast re-education camps constructed in the long valleys by follow-on teams of Mechanicum pioneers. Over the course of the 3 months since the death of the Phoenix Court, the entire repository of the Great Library was copied via pict scanners or transcribed by thousands of quill servitors under the supervision of Anku Anen. The Primarch of the Thousand Suns devoured each text, digesting every morsel in the library faster than even the most advanced data savant could process it. Camille Shivani spent almost every waking minute in the library, poring over the histories of Heliosa and the earliest legends regarding the mythical birthrock of Terra. Immersed in the wealth of information, she studied the texts as any scholar might, but also freely indulged her talent for reading the imprints of past owners. Many of the histories were written by men with no connection to the events they described, or by those who had won the wars they wrote about, and were thus of little value beyond subjective descriptions. Tucked away in a neglected chamber near the top of the pyramid structure, however, Camille found a flaking, ochre-stained book that changed everything. Many of its pages were illegible, thanks to moisture damage, but no sooner had she touched it than she knew she wouldn't need to read the words to unlock its secrets. This was history written by someone who had lived through it, an authentic account of an alien world as it passed through a turbulent period of change. In an instant, she knew the writer, a young man from the south by the name of Caleb. She felt his hopes and dreams, his passions and his vices. Through his eyes, Camille lived a lifetime of joys and regrets, learning of his time nearly 2,000 years ago, when the tribal city-states of Heliosa had united under the belief in an ancient thunder god from their earliest days to defeat a marauding race from the stars. Anku Anen was thrilled by Camille's accounts of Caleb's time, and immediately assigned her an Astartes Zealoter from the Athenaeum cult to skim the thoughts from her mind and transcribe them via a scrivener harness. From that moment on, any book of unknown provenance was brought to Camille for authentication. In contrast, Lemuel Gauman was a stranger in the Great Library. His time belonged to Adaman, who continued his intensive training in the proper use of his abilities and how to shield his presence from the void predators that swam the shallows of the Great Ocean. Only once did Lemuel attempt to broach the subject of what had happened to Hastar upon the causeway before the Great Library. The dreadfully transformed body had been returned to the Fotep and placed in stasis, but the shadow of its horrific death hung over the Thousand Suns like a guilty secret. No sooner had he asked than he knew he had touched an exposed nerve. "He could not control his power," said Araman, with a haunted, reflexive glance towards the silver oakleaf cluster on his shoulder guard. Lemuel made a mental note to ask about that symbol in quieter times, for it was clear there was a link. Could that, what did you call it, flesh change happen to you? Asked Lemuel, all too aware that he was treading on dangerous ground.
He promised it would never happen again to any of us, said Araman, and Lemuel read the hurt betrayal in his aura, its nearness too raw and naked to conceal. Araman's words spoke of the cold dread of prey that can sense the nearness of a stalking predator. To know that Astartes could feel such emotion shocked Lemuel.
Araman would be drawn no further, and nothing more was said on the matter as Lemuel's teachings continued. He was taught how to free his body of light from his body of flesh, and fly the invisible currents and thermals of the ether. Such voyages were short, for his skill had not yet developed enough to allow him any great time apart from his flesh. Between such instructional times, Lemuel was in his element, travelling from city to city in the company of a squad of Astartes from Araman's First Fellowship to document the reconstruction of a world first-hand. These warriors were all philosophers, a rank so far above Lemuel's provisional one of neophyte that it made him dizzy to think a man could master the mysteries so completely. Mechanicum forge vessels, city-sized monoliths bringing vast builder machines and billions of tons of raw materials, dropped into the lower atmosphere like continents set adrift in the sky. The descent of such enormous cities of metal through the atmosphere set off a butterfly effect of clashing tempests that howled and raged across the world before settling into a continuous downpour that lasted 2 months. Campfire Scuttlebutt had it that the planet's inhabitants believed their world was weeping for its conquered people. But no sooner were the iterators made aware of this morsel than it was spun afresh that the rains were the planet washing away the stains of the old days. In conjunction with this, anonymously sourced tales painting the kings of the Phoenix Court as corrupt despots who exploited the people for their own selfish ends were subtly fed into the rumour mill. As the iterators did their work in the Deep Valley re-education camps, public debates and potent examples of the Imperium's majesty were unveiled to the people of Heliosa. Lemuel studied the techniques used by the Imperial speakers, noting the armsmen discreetly placed to drag off hecklers, the native turncoat planted within an audience to reinforce the speaker's message with loud agreement, and the unseen voxbee that flitted through the crowds to broadcast Imperial-friendly questions to which the answers were already prepared. Each iterator had a team of investigators, whose task it was to unearth local beliefs and traditions, which were then embellished and finally supplanted with subtly altered versions that reinforced loyalty to the Imperium. The work of the Thousand Suns in the Great Library proved to be an enormous help with this. Magnus's legion hardly strayed from the library, but the word-bearers worked closely with the iterators, providing security for the camps and reinforcing the teachings with their own brand of loyalty. Lemuel found this element of compliance the most distasteful, seeing the indigenous culture of a world gradually overwhelmed by the Imperium's doctrines like a cuckoo invading a nest. The word-bearer's version of the Imperial truth was particularly hard-line, and Lemuel soon grew weary of the hectoring rhetoric that smelled more of indoctrination than it did of education. It was rumoured that the Emperor had chastised Lorgar's legion in the past for such zeal, but even if that were true, it seemed the lesson hadn't stuck. The Imperium was benign. It did bring hope in the form of unity, but the word-bearer's argument seemed absurdly petulant, posited along the lines of a schoolyard bully's argument. "We are right because we say we are right," it said. "Agree with us and we will be friends. Disagree with us and we will be enemies." That was no way to win the hearts and minds of a conquered people, but what other choice was there? It rankled that this new beginning had to be won with linguistic subterfuge and outright intimidation. But Lemuel was not naive enough to believe that a populace who had fought so hard to resist the Imperium would be brought to compliance without such stratagems. It would shorten the process massively if the populace could be made to believe they were better off now than they were before. What saddened Lemuel most was that it seemed to be working. Lemuel was reminded of the ancient text Camille had shown him, the Shiji, a meticulous record of a grand historian that glorified the ruling emperor while vilifying the previous dynasty. In his quieter, darker moments, Lemuel would often wonder if the Imperium was really as enlightened as it claimed. Like a Goru, an Imperial commander was appointed to oversee the Arkreach cluster and the long years of reconstruction and integration that lay ahead.
Where Agoru received a civilian administrator, Heliosa required a firmer hand. Major General Hestor Navarre was a senior officer of the Uranti Drax, a regiment of swarthy-skinned fighters exclusively recruited from the desiccated jungle regions of Sud-America. A career soldier of High Brazil, Navarre had fought his way across 100 battlefields alongside the Word-Bearers, and his appointment was greeted with sage approval. Unlike Agoru, scores of regiments were dispersed through the conquered Arkreach cluster. Imperial administration burrowed its way into every level of society, replacing defunct planetary rulers with imperial delegates and the infrastructure to allow them to function. Munitorium officials calculated each planet's worth to the Imperium, while storytellers and mythmakers travelled system-wide, extolling the glorious history of mankind. 4 months after the collapse of resistance, word came that the last text of the Phoenix Crag Library had been copied into the archive stacks of the FOTEP. A day later, the 28th Expeditionary Fleet broke orbit, and Magnus the Red gave the order to make best speed for an isolated shoal of spatial debris in the galactic east of the Ark Reach. The various shipmasters of the 28th Expedition queried the coordinates, as they were far from the calculated system jump point, but Magnus's order was confirmed. This region of space would allow their vessels a calmer entry to the great ocean, and only when the fleet had reached this newly declared jump point did Magnus reveal their ultimate destination. The 28th Expedition had been summoned to the Ulanor system, and excitement spread through the fleet at the prospect of joining the war against the Greenskin. More thrilling was the prospect of joining forces with the Emperor himself, who fought in the forefront of the campaign, smiting the savage foe alongside Horus Lupercal. Hopes of glory to be earned and battles to be fought were dashed, only to be replaced by awe, as it became known that the campaign was already over. The war against the Greenskins of Ulanor had been projected to last years, decades even. The Emperor's summons was not in the name of war, but of victory. The Thousand Suns were to stand with many of their brother legions in a great triumph honouring the Emperor's victory, a spectacle the likes of which the galaxy would never see again. Under Magnus's expert direction, the fleet navigators plotted a razor's course for the Ulanor system. The expedition fleet of the Word-Bearers was deeply enmeshed in the integration of the worlds of the Arkreach into the Imperium, and Lorgar would pull his warriors out and make for Ulanor when they were able. Magnus and Lorgar said their goodbyes briefly, the mighty Primarch speaking words that only they could hear. But as Ahriman watched them part, he caught a flicker of Magnus's aura, the faintest whisper of something indefinable, yet disquieting. The last time he had seen it had been when Magnus and Russ had almost come to blows.